Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Jim and Austin, welcome this morning. A lot of things on Strategy Page have been popping up about Chinese weapons and the Chinese doing this and that. What is their major effort here, Jim, as far as weapons development? I know that they've got the aircraft carrier that's getting close. They've got their new series of aircraft that are supposedly aircraft capable. Where are they headed with all of this?
Well, if you want to know what the Chinese are doing, there's a book on it, which was written several thousand years ago. It was written by Sun Tzu, S-U-N-T-Z-U. And they are basically operating right out of the Sun Tzu playbook. Number one, they're spending as little as possible. You know, for all the new weapons that the Chinese come up with, they rarely put them into mass production. And actually, in the Chinese language media, they take it for granted. They'll discuss it, but they take it for granted. Why build a lot of weapons you're never going to use? That brings up the second point. They have no interest in getting into a war. Sun Tzu said the best battle is one you don't have to fight. And that's been basically something that Chinese generals ever since have held as, you know, the highest achievement. You know, defeating the enemy without anybody getting killed, or very few people getting killed. And that is the kind of war they're fighting. That's why they're putting so much effort. I forget what they call it. They have a word for it in English. But these stealthy technologies, these stealthy tactics, like the internet-based espionage, they've got so many of our so-called secrets. You know, they put WikiLeaks to shame. And they just want this stuff so that they have an idea of what they're going to go up against, because they realize that right now, they say, quite frankly, we're spending too much on the military. You know, a little unsolicited advice that rings somewhat true, given our current financial situation. They're basically preparing themselves to fight on the cheap, because they find that, again, Sun Tzu pointed it out, and throughout history there have been many examples of, you know, that working. But at the same time, something the Chinese don't talk a lot about in public, it does pop up in military publications, which, you know, you can with some difficulty get access to, but they're basically for, you know, the military alone, the corruption problem. It's a huge problem. And occasionally it pops up in the Chinese media when they execute some colonel or some general, or throw them in jail for a long time. But, you know, from the contacts I have over there, you know who know people, a cousin or whatever, who's in the military, and they just chat, usually over drinks. They said, it's a big problem, and the communists are trying to get rid of it, and they've been trying for over 20 years now. Some things become public, like, I think it was almost 20 years ago, they forced the army to get rid of all its arms factories, which had basically gone into the business of selling sports weapons to, you know, Westerners, because that was more profitable. The hell with, you know, new weapons for the troops. A lot of their weapons development projects go on interminably. Now, that means either incompetence or corruption. If they were Indian, I'd say incompetence, because the Indians have a unique kind of bureaucracy. But for the Chinese, it's usually corruption. You know, people are plundering the budget, telling them to just keep going. I mean, for example, there's an ancient saying in China which goes that the main purpose of politics is not to win or lose, but to keep the game going. In other words, we can keep plundering, you know, the government as long as the government is still there, but don't rock the boat. And that's basically the attitude of the military. The last war they fought was in 79, and older Chinese, especially guys who were there, they just don't like to talk about it. I mean, I've asked friends of mine over there to, you know, hey, you know so-and-so, he was in the army in the 70s, yada, yada. And more than once I've had people come back to me and say, you got to get him real drunk for him to even talk about it. And when he does, he's got nothing good to say about the, you know, the Red Army, or the Chinese People's Liberation Army. And even those who talk about it sober are even more, bitter, as it were. And we have the incident, what was it, back in 03 when the Chinese aircraft, through incompetence flying, damaged an American reconnaissance aircraft, which had to land on a Chinese island. And when that was investigated, it was found out there was all sorts of incompetence, you know, on the Chinese side, not just the pilot who got himself killed. We reported, just read Strategy Page. I mean, the fairly recently where a submarine lost the entire crew because somebody turned the wrong thing on the air supply and everybody suffocated. There's a lot of that, but there's also a lot of it you never read about at the command level, just making stupid decisions. So that's one reason why the Chinese don't want to go to war. Don't want to spend a lot of money on it because they realize a lot of it's going to get stolen. But they do want to appear strong. That doesn't take too much effort for China to scare its neighbors. You know, China's been throwing its weight around economically. It's not afraid of hurting neighbors. It expects neighbors to deal with China the way they always have. They're talking thousands of years now. And the neighbors don't want to do that. For about 200 years, the neighbors have been off the reservation. You know, the Westerners came in, kept the empire busy, eventually destroyed the empire with all this democracy, you know, crap. And now the Chinese are making a comeback. The communists consider themselves, if not openly, but in spirit, you know, the heirs to the imperial throne. And the neighbors are saying, no, screw you, Jack, which is unheard of. And the Chinese don't know quite how to process this, which is making the Chinese rather rambunctious. You know, they've unleashed the nationalist, attitude, which has gotten out of hand a couple of times. But they don't really know quite how to handle it. The neighbors aren't behaving. You have the United States. China has never had anything like the United States. They've always had the northern barbarians, you know, the Mongols, the Manchus, what have you, the Huns. And they either, you know, defeated them or got conquered and absorbed them. But how do you deal with the United States? The only reference point they have is Japan, which went to war with the United States. The next thing they knew, Japan was a smoking ruin. Now, the Chinese didn't, you know, really shed any tears over that. But for a lesson in geopolitics, it's a little scary. The barbarians from the east are apparently potentially a lot worse than the old barbarians from the north. So they are basically grasping for, you know, a redefinition of their military strategy. But in the meantime, they're holding to the tried and true. Don't spend a lot of money. Look as strong as you can. Try to find ways to finesse the enemy. You know, steal the secrets. You know, this ballistic missile that can hunt down, you know, the aircraft carriers. Whatever it takes. And basically try and bully your way to a victory. Because the last thing you want to do is get involved in a real war with the United States. They've noticed that. That never ends well for the people on the other side.
Now, what about their conflicts with India?
That's more, you know, diplomatic bullying. They see India as a potential problem because so many Chinese, you see, another thing that's changed with the new China, the old China for thousands of years didn't need Navy, shipping, overseas trade was a luxury. It was not a necessity. Now it's a necessity. Oil comes in, other raw materials comes in, food comes in. Exported goods, which are only a small part of their economy. I mean, most of the economic growth in China is internal. You know, building more stuff for Chinese to consume. We tend to lose sight of that. The export stuff is important, but it's becoming less and less important, and it was never, except maybe in the first decade, really all that critical. The Indian Ocean is a problem. And they don't trust the Indians. They've never regarded the Indians as anything but, you know, some strange people over the high mountains. China never really controlled Tibet for a long time because they couldn't breathe up there. I mean, there was no there. And they only came back in the 50s after having been, you know, lost control of it, I think, since the 1910 revolution against the empire. The Tibetans kicked it, what few Chinese administrators there were out. And the Chinese had other things to bother with, you know, and they didn't come back until the 1950s. But now they're on the border. They want the old, while the Tibetans were running their own affairs, the Tibetans settled the border with India, with Britain, actually. Of course, they didn't consult Beijing, the Chinese, and the Chinese took offense at that. So now they're basically trying to bully the Indians into giving up disputed territory. They had that war in, was it 1963-64, which the Chinese won. But the Indians are trying to prepare for a rematch, and apparently are not going to be as easy an opponent, you know, if there's another war. But again, the Chinese really don't want a war. A war between India and China is a logistical nightmare, and it could be very expensive. Plus, both nations have nuclear weapons. And India is building more nuclear weapons that can reach Chinese targets. And the Chinese don't have that many nuclear weapons to begin with. So it's not a classic situation. It's not a situation that fits any past model. In other words, the Chinese love to use history, but there was never anything like nuclear weapons in the Chinese history. So with this new stuff, they figured, hey, let's just play around with the Indians. And that's basically what they're doing. And that's the way most diplomats regard it. All right, we got to play games. Great. You know, there's really no big downside because neither side is stupid enough to actually start shooting over this. So a lot of this posturing that China is going through with all of its neighbors is just that, posturing. They basically want to have some good times. They had two centuries of bad times. And, you know, China, long memories, you know, are considered a polite thing to have. And so anytime Chinese sit around for a meal or a few drinks and what have you, they're going to talk about the good times and how much everybody wants them to, you know, keep on going.
Right. Austin, China has been trying to exert, or they are exerting, a lot of influence over into Africa. What are their goals there, and why do they want such a huge presence in Africa?
Well, I want to pick up. I'm going to get into that kind of tangentially because we're talking about the Indian Ocean as a problem.
Right.
Why is it a problem? Supply lines. Sea lane supply lines running through the Indian Ocean. And you just take a look at the Indian Ocean. I actually did a column about this, and then Jim and I both used this description in the past in talking about India's influence in Southeast Asia, Indian Ocean, and really extending now all the way to Eastern Africa. Just take a look at the Indian Ocean, and there's this giant V, you know, or a big spear point that drops down into the Indian Ocean, and that's India. And here are all these ships moving from Southwest Asia and Africa, carrying crude oil and an array of raw materials headed for China's headed for China. This is the source material for China's booming economy, and it runs right past India. And Indian Navy is no slouch. It models itself after the Royal Navy. They have sailors who know what to do. And the Chinese, even as Jim described, what he sees as their operational bullying, but strategic reluctance, I think that's a good way to put it. When I say operational bullying, the example being the South China Sea, they want to control the Paracel Islands, the Spratlys and the like, and maybe oil down there, and they're going to scare the Philippines and Thailand and certainly Vietnam on this. But they really don't want it to get out of hand. They want to shove their shoulders. They really don't want to get into a fist fight. That's what I mean by strategic reluctance. But they sit there and they see all that material coming out of Southwest Asia and Africa. The other choice, of course, would be to send it through the Panama Canal around Cape Horn, and otherwise go the other way across the Pacific. That adds the shipping costs, and, you know, the direct route is to the Indian Ocean, Straits of Malacca, and then up the South China Sea. So, let's go to your question. What are they interested in Africa? Natural resources. They have really, and this goes back, Dan, almost three decades. here it is, it's 2011, and I'm talking about elements of this were in play in the, really in the mid-1980s, as Chinese diplomats were making contact with African governments. They were always there as to some degree. As a matter of fact, one of the Cold War oddities is that both Red Communist China and the United States at one time were both backing one of the Angolan, the same Angolan guerrilla group. They had been there doing that during the Cold War, but their diplomacy began to shift. One of the signals for that was Deng Xiaoping's opening and reform, which begins in really in the 1980s, very much so after 1979, that terrible border war that the Chinese fought with Vietnam. Jim mentioned that that was the last war they fought. Well, the Vietnamese gave the Chinese a licking in that border war, and Chinese saw, just even as, despite the immense size of their of the People's Liberation Army, they were only able to fight the Vietnamese to a draw, and it was a deadly draw. I don't know what the kill rate was, but the Chinese took far more severe casualties than the Vietnamese. There's some estimates out there, but one of them is that 20,000 Chinese were killed by the Vietnamese. Well, they don't want to lose to the Vietnamese, so they've got to modernize their army. Part of that is modernizing their economy. They already had the four modernizations in progress. You can see that actually coming out of the mid-70s, and Zhou Enlai, to pull in a great figure from the past, it was articulating that. So opening reform is to try to spur China's economy, develop its economy, open its economy, and therefore it needs resources. And to show you how the Chinese are thinking in a comprehensive way, Jim invoked Sun Tzu when he started talking about the elements of Sun Tzu deception and so the perception and the perception of strength so that you don't have to fight. Sun Tzu also makes arguments for a completely comprehensive political military approach, and understand that war itself is expensive, but in order to be able to be prepared for war, you're going to have economic strength. So the diplomats in Africa begin approaching the government, saying, you know, we're interested in signing deals to get some of the to get copper, to get cobalt, to get oil. And you certainly see this begin blossom, particularly in the late 1990s and early 2000s, in places like Sudan, where the Sudanese government, I'm talking about Khartoum now, since there really are now two Sudans, officially two Sudans, there are probably about six real Sudans, but two Sudans now, they became effectively the United Nations protector of the Sudanese government in Khartoum, even as they're waging war against the South and then conducting their genocidal war in Darfur. And why? It's because as China, as long as China was getting the oil, I know that Sudan doesn't really begin shipping oil in a major way until early in the last decade, but they were developing those resources, and China wanted to call on them. Same thing out of Angola. The most interesting deal is one that's really been worked out in the last 3 years, and it's led to charges that Beijing is neo-imperialist. Well, I think they are in a certain lens, and that's their deal with the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo. They're going to provide infrastructure, and the Congolese are going to, in exchange for this infrastructure building, roads, electrical lines, and the like, they're going to guarantee them a significant amount of minerals and other raw materials. Interestingly enough, based on what we've read about the contracts, the Chinese are not going to rely on local labor. They're going to bring in their own labor to do it. And this is another one of the issues going on in Congo, saying, well, wait a minute, we should be able to get some of these jobs. and the like. But that's that is not only diplomatic, but it's a diplomatic economic strategy that they've pursued. Now, to get it from Africa to China, they got to put it on ships, and that comes into some of the potential issues between India and China. China now has extraordinary overseas interests, because I'll get touch on the domestic side of that now. Here's the deal going on inside China, which is, as long as everybody's getting rich, the Communist Party is going to stay in power. The dictatorship has made a deal, and the deal is they're going to let the Chinese people get rich as long as the Chinese people do not challenge the ultimate authority of the Communist Party. Well, what happens when the economy goes into a recession or hiccups, or, as Jim pointed out, the corruption issue, people's wedded expectations for having more cash. They're wedded, they're working, and they see senior communist Chinese officials or the folks in the network raking in millions from corrupt deals, bribery, and the like on that, and they resent it. And now the Chinese workers who have own capital themselves, they've had a taste of success. The party turns around and they realize that they've been riding a tiger. They've built a tiger that could bite them back, which feeds back into what's going on in Africa and Southwest Asia. And that is, they've got to maintain those resource supply lines to feed the economy. Also feeds back to a point that Jim made is, you know, a war would really be a bad idea, particularly one with the United States, since you depend on the United States as a market for your goods. And if you go to war with the United States, which would drag in Canada and drag in, likely, you know, drag in NATO allies and South Korea and the like, suddenly, no matter how you play it, how you try to galvanize nationalist passions and the like, you've got an economic issue if you are a nation relying on exports, which is what China is. And that has domestic issues with immediately. Have I helped explain some of this complicated situation, Dan?
Yes.
I hope so.
Now, Jim, we sort of reported that China's biggest enemy is internal, especially as some of their economic things are starting to get a little bit out of control on them, such as the price of food. I know we're complaining about our price of food going up here in the United States, but theirs is at a 14% inflation rate right now.
Yeah, well, they're having inflation problems, not just because of the worldwide, you know, increase in food prices, but also because they have an overheated economy. Again, this is the corruption. The corruption extends to the banks. This is a big potential problem for them. The population is liable to have to take a financial bath, which might result in a revolution, which is why the government is so concerned about it. Basically, a lot of banks are state-controlled or heavily state-influenced, and they've been lending a lot of money, which isn't getting paid back. You know, a lot of it is to build housing that isn't being sold. That sound familiar? They don't just have a property bubble going for them. They got a industrial expansion bubble as well, which is another reason why they need those exports. But again, a lot of the stuff that's being manufactured in China is for Chinese markets, and if those Chinese consumers don't have money to buy this stuff, there's a problem. Now, one thing the Chinese government has going for them, Chinese have a much higher savings rate. Partially that's pragmatism, not virtue. There's no real good health insurance system in the country. There's no real social safety net. So you gotta take care of yourself, because the state ain't gonna do it. Well, actually, as a practical matter, the state ain't been doing it for a long, long time. Communist propaganda notwithstanding. The Chinese are not stupid. They know what's going on. And now they have a chance to make money, put money in a bank that they're reasonably sure, you know, is not going to go poof. And the Chinese government is now facing a economic disaster far worse than the one we've been through. That's why inflation is the least of their worries right now. They're basically trying to deflate this problem. I guess that's the best metaphor I could use. You know, without causing a mess. Bankers worldwide are concerned about it because they hold so much, you know, U.S. debt. You know, if they get in trouble, you know, they're going to start dumping, you know, U.S. Treasury instruments on the market, and boom, things get very unpleasant worldwide. So it's not just China anymore.
Right. Directly affects everybody in the world. One last
question. The Chinese love that, by the way. They love being able to, you know, bring down the world economy. I mean, they won't say that out loud, but that does fill them with pride.
Well, it makes them the center of the world, in a sense, Jim. I mean,
which is what they always consider themselves.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
It feeds right back into that national...
cultural meme.
National myth. And just because I'm calling it a myth doesn't mean it isn't real. That's a sense of identification. You know,
well, it's real to the Chinese and myth to everybody else, but we'll let that go.
Well, one last thing that I wanted to talk about was we had heard a lot in past years about the new space race and how China was entering the space race, but we certainly haven't heard much about their space program lately.
Oh, it's going forward. They are doing a lot of work at steady, you know, progress in their space-based operations. Now, most of it is strictly economic. They are a very cost-effective launcher of satellites, both for the international market and for themselves. But at the same time, they are using some of this capability to, you know, they're putting people in space. They're talking about putting somebody on the moon. In other words, they want to make the people love the government. That's what it basically comes down to. I mean, I think it came out eventually that JFK, you know, I forget what the exact quote was, but he basically admitted that this whole man on the moon thing was basically bread and circuses. Again, that's not his exact words, but that was basically what he was saying. He was kind of dragged into it. And that's what the Chinese basically, and the Chinese are hungry for that because for 200 years, and in many people, you know, in their own lifetimes, you grandfathers, grandparents in China, they remember hard times. And their grandparents remember hard. It's been nothing but hard times as far back as the, you know, collective memory goes. So everybody's pumped for some good news, you know, as far as China goes. So that's why the space program, they're not spending a lot of money on it. Basically, it's piggybacking on other projects. And they're in many cases, they appear to be waiting for technology, for someone else to develop technology that they can buy or steal and then incorporate into their program. Because remember, they're doing something we did almost 50 years ago. But they just want to do it cheaper and not necessarily safer, but cheaper. They don't want to break the bank, you know, just to put on a little PR, you know, event.
Right. Well, that wraps it up for our take a look at China again. Try to visit them at least once or twice a year so that we can keep our tabs on what they're doing. We'll be talking about something next time, and we'll see you then, gentlemen.
Bye, Dan.
Bye.